And I'm very passionate about the fact that almost every parent I know would do exactly what I did if only they were told that that's mm-hmm. what you should do.
Welcome to the Juggling the Chaos of Recovery podcast, where we focus on health, wellness, and overcoming all types of addictions. You're in the right place if you're a mom, dad, friend, sibling, or caregiver who has a loved one who is or was struggling with an eating disorder or any other kind of addiction. In a time when everything seems heavy, I'm here to bring you a real yet lighthearted take on what the heck we are all supposed to do with our lives while we care for our loved ones who are struggling. One thing holds true throughout it all. You can't juggle the chaos without smiling, at least a little bit. All right. Well, welcome to another episode of the podcast, Juggling the Chaos of Recovery. I'm so glad that you're here. And I'm super excited today because I have another friend, guest to join us today that I am really excited. I'm actually very, very honored that she said yes to me as I asked her to be a guest here. Today we have JT Ouellette, and she's a gal that I met through, there are so many Facebook support groups for parents and moms and caregivers of children with eating disorders, and her name continued to come up as a wonderful resource. And so I had reached out to her many times, just asking different questions about programs, about ideas, and she's been a really great great help for me, and she is just a wonderful resource. So, and she has a great story to tell as well. So I wanted to bring her on today. So let me read her bio, which is fairly extensive and awesome. So JT Ouellette is a professional educator who now works in the eating disorder field as an expert by experience through her business, JT Ouellette Peer Coaching. In 2012, the youngest of JT's four children developed anorexia nervosa, and she and her husband experienced the pain and feelings of being overwhelmed that follow any devastating medical diagnosis. They quickly realized they were extremely lucky to be able to access state-of-the-art treatment at the UC San Diego Center for Eating Disorder Treatments and Research, and had excellent care that focused as much on training them to support recovery for the long term as it did in providing care for their daughter. Their daughter and their family's journey was not easy or short, and it was successful. She lives her life free of an eating disorder today and is employed in her dream career. JT began to provide support for other caregivers through her membership in the UCSD Parent Advisory Council and in online forums, and began attending professional conferences. JT is a past member of the Joint Commission's Patient Technical Advisory Committee on Behavioral Health when they were finalizing eating disorders treatment regulations, a co-founder of the World Eating Disorder Action Day, speaks regularly at conferences, and is a board member of FEAST. JT is best known for her full metal apron approach to fighting eating disorders and her motto that one must see the beast to slay the beast. So welcome, JT. I am so glad that you joined us today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Great, great. Well, why don't we start with your story, your daughter's story, and how that eating disorder came about or started in your family, and you know, how that happened.
I love that you said your story and your daughter's story, because that's one of the things. Sometimes there's some pushback. Some parents think that I shouldn't speak so freely about what they consider to be my daughter's story. And I've had her permission from day one, so she's been wonderful about that. I was a mommy blogger before this started, and so she was I always asked my kids if I could tell their stories, and they always said yes. But I do firmly believe that there is her story, there's my story, there's our story, her sibling's story, and, you know, that we're all sort of entitled to our piece of that experience. Again, I am lucky because she does her own speaking and writing on this as well, so that makes it nice. But really the short version of it is, in 2012, the youngest of my four children, Kinsey, was 17 years old, a senior in high school, and had always been a very happy, healthy child, no trauma, nothing, just a really great San Diego suburban life spent at the pool and the beach and all that kind of stuff. She was an excellent student and athlete and all those sorts of things. And she and her friends began a healthy eating makeover after their sport was done, thinking we don't want to put on the freshman 15 next year. And it all seemed very reasonable until very quickly it was not reasonable at all. And we had no idea, A, we had no idea that anorexia was genetic, and B, we had no idea that her grandmother had had it. And so I will say that people come into this in different ways. Some people do sort of a slow burn, and some people do a really quick thing. And for my daughter, it was like she was standing at the top of an icy slope on a banana peel. Mm. And so it went really, she went down hard and she went down fast. And the gift in that is that there's sort of no ignoring what's happening. And we were very lucky. We spent a relatively short time with the pediatrician, doing the GI stuff, wondering why she could no longer, sort of eat. And she very strongly had the symptom of nosognosia, which is lack of insight. So she actually had no idea she was ill at all. And so nobody else did either. But as things went and the intake continued to decline and the weight continued to decline, and I won't discuss numbers because that's tricky, but it was pretty precipitous and severe. We just all of a sudden one day it became crystal clear that what we were dealing with, and very, again, lucky to be in San Diego. Had no idea UCSD was such a great place for treatment. And that being said, our journey was still not easy. She was in treatment for a total of 7 months and missed, never went back to high school that year, and then missed a semester of college as well. Being an educator, we are definitely an education family, so really happy at the skilled people at UCSD that sort of got my head straight pretty quickly that all that stuff goes to the side. You got a job, it's saving your daughter's life. Mm-hmm. And again, one of the things, once I started delving into peer support forums, realized how unusual it was, how included we were, how much the treatment team depended on our knowledge of our daughter and what made her tick, and then how supportive they were. With UC San Diego, the parents get about 12 hours a week of therapy and training and with other parents. And so I needed every single one of those 12 hours, and I was there for a very long time. I got the whole DBT book twice. Mm. And, it was, again, not an easy or short road. A lot of tough. The Full Metal Apron moniker sort of comes from, I really felt like, once I realized what was happening, I had to really gird up for battle before every meal and every snack, and really understand that I was not fighting my daughter, but I was fighting for her, and that anorexia was making her very resistant. So very hard. If you've been a collaborative, cooperative parent, as I tried to be, as I strove to be as a teacher as well, to all of a sudden have to, everything you have to do to get your kid well is the opposite of what good parents do. And I even said at one point when I was learning about family-based treatment, which we did, I was like, hang on a minute, let me get this straight. You're telling me in order to help my daughter beat anorexia, I have to become the caricature of the Lifetime TV movie ABC After School Special Mom, who was so controlling she caused anorexia. And they're like, good way to put it. Uh-huh, that's what we're saying.
Yeah. Right. Wow. Yeah,
but today, just to sort of bring it into the present day, she's 25 years old, just very, very happy, has a wonderful boyfriend, has a fantastic job. She's in law enforcement now and, had got 2 degrees just about on time and everything. So really, really a strong proponent of this is a health crisis like cancer. Let's take this. Let's deal with this. And then we'll try and go back into real life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I wish I met you several years ago.
I think I get that a lot, and it makes me very sad. And I'll tell you what, one thing I get as well is when I speak at conferences, there's oftentimes women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s at these conferences. And after I speak, they'll come up and they'll, hug me and say, I just wish my mom would have done what you did. And I almost universally say, honey, your mom probably would have done it if she would have known it was what to do. This is literally very brand new information. And even of the people who know it, a lot of people just still have so many old ideas. And I'm very passionate about the fact that almost every parent I know would do exactly what I did if only they were told that that's mm-hmm. what you should do.
Right. Right. I definitely agree with that. And I think that, what I'm hoping to bring, to light in this podcast is, just this chaos. At least I named it that because I felt like that's what was happening around me. And as a mom, I didn't know what to do. And I was trying to, you know, we always, you know, we're trying to raise our kids to be independent. And, and again, like you said, let's work together and you do this. And I don't know, I wish I had learned about this type of schooling because it's just so, it's difficult.
It's counterintuitive. This is everything is like, it's just the opposite of what you would normally do. And that's really, really hard to grasp. And I think, you know, it's counterintuitive and it's also painful. And so if people don't know how pain, that the pain is normal, you know, you just think this cannot be right. Yeah, it's very hard.
Yeah. And I'm sure many that are listening understand, or I hope they understand. I will say that, you know, when we get angry at our child and we're fighting with them, you know, like you said, we're not fighting. I mean, we are fighting for their life, right? But we're fighting against something that's not them. I certainly know that with my daughter when she's been in the depths of just terribleness.
Everything changes. Their eyes change. Everything changes. And I think an additional challenge for most people is that these have almost always been really good kids. Like they, like almost you didn't have to parent them. Like they wanted to be great students. They wanted to be great athletes. You know, it was all good. We're just all chugging along, just, you know, achieving our little hearts out. And that is really hard to come to terms with. I truly feel like it was, my daughter was really 17 and a half before I really had to sort of, you know, parent her in a super, super, you know, hands-on directed way like that, just because her instincts were to do what I wanted to do. And also because she had, you know, three older siblings, I was done. I tell people when I, my very first speech I ever gave at a conference was at the National Eating Disorders Association conference in San Antonio, Texas, in I think 2013 or 2014. And I was a replacement for someone else, for June Alexander, who's an amazing, you don't know her, she's an advocate in Australia who recovered quite late in life, but phenomenal. And in sort of attempting to inject some humor into the whole situation, I talk about the fact that I was completely done cooking when this happened. My her older siblings were all at grad school or in college, and my husband, her dad, was living and working in another state for economic reasons. That's what the job was. And so I was all like, woohoo, you know, I've been cooking dinner for 30 years every single night. And now, you know, it's just two women in the house, basically, who we eat toast, we eat whatever. And that's what I say, that's when the universe really laughed. And the next thing I knew, I was cooking for her life.
Wow. Absolutely. And so I do like to always say, you know, what was the, was there chaos? What was the chaos like? You know, how did this, impact the family, although you're saying that your older siblings were gone out of the house?
You know, I think for one thing, of the fear impacts everyone. I mean, the just abject terror of, I think one of the things that makes anorexia hard, and I will always say it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, and I provided end-of-life care for my mother and sister who died of cancer at 61 and 41. One of her brothers has Tourette syndrome. You know, we just like, so it's not like I had some, you know, just bubblegum path life or whatever. But I think the first part of it is that what is one of the most fundamental jobs of a parent? Feed your child. And so when you are just absolutely, it's impossible for you to do the one basic parenting thing, that just really messes with your mind. It is really, really hard. That lays you, you know, just sort of flat out. And absolutely, you know, sort of in terms of you know, the chaos of everything, it's your emotional stuff too. I mean, I know like for my husband, you know, he processed a lot of the fear sort of came out as anger, you know? And so we had to get in touch with what, you know, you're not really mad at her, you're terrified and you don't know how to express that. And, you know, she was very lucky. Her siblings were incredibly supportive to her from, you know, sort of from a distance. Her grandmother, my mother-in-law, actually sent her a card every single day. Every single day she was in treatment. So I think the supports of all of that were really helpful. We still did get a lot of, you know, the people around us did know, like, you have to, like, friendship, time, all that gone, you know, absolutely gone. And so you know who your friends are because they're the ones that understand when you just drop off the face of the earth. I just think it was so hard. The hardest thing about it all in terms of the cast was, you know, that on the one hand, you had this kid who was just such a great kid and going on and doing her life and knew where she's going to college, had her dreams. And then the next thing you know, like, I really had like a raging, you know, just like a cornered animal just lashing out. And when my husband and I would talk at night, because he was out of state and my own personal life talk about chaos. So I had to keep working full time if we wanted to keep our insurance and luckily very, you know, professional job with flexibility with my employer. But some days I was driving 200 miles. I didn't know if I was coming, going or what I was doing. And but I would report to my husband. He'd say like, well, how did it go? And we were on a very significant number of calories for her to be able to gain. And I would say, well, her head spun around 3 times, you know, and, and then again, you know, just sort of what is involved with this. We had, you know, we had not only language that, you know, could go up against any, like, not just one sailor, but a whole, like, ship full of them. And, you know, also, you know, physical lashing out and destruction of, you know, property kind of stuff like that, which is just, you know, how did we get here? You know, and how I never thought I would have to be able to know how to handle, you know, my daughter, you know, throwing cutlery at me. That's just was not in my wheelhouse or skill set, you know.
So. Now, how did your relationship with your daughter change during this time? I'm assuming it did.
Yes, it did. And so I would say, you know, I think she's my baby for sure, and sure does love the baby role. We all kind of joke, how can somebody be a daddy's girl and a mama's girl at the exact same time? But she definitely accomplished that. And so that was just, yeah, that part of it was really hard. But for me, I think part of it, again, the gift of her severe decline was that I was under no illusions about what I was fighting for. I was literally fighting for my daughter's life from moment one. Because that's, you know, sort of where we came at this. And I instinctively knew you can repair a relationship with a live child and the relationship is over if your child doesn't make it. So we had, just a lot of stuff. And the thing of it is too, I tell people, it's like anorexia has basically the Rolodex of their brain and can kind of go like, you know, let's flip through and find what's going to hurt the parents most. Where, you know, and so I do not like to be thought of as a controlling person. You know, I attempt not to be a controlling person. And anorexia knew that would really hurt my feelings a lot. So I got that a lot. And I even got that, you know, sort of later on in the process because we did practice a very severe, intense relapse prevention program, even once she went back to school, which was wait at the student health center twice a week or twice a month. That was sent to the psychiatrist. And we had a very strict, we knew what the numbers needed to be. And, you know, literally if she was 6 pounds below where she needed to be, she was coming home for the entire semester. And in addition to that, I drove 16 miles round trip once a month for two years to eat with her, which, you know, most college freshmen and sophomore don't go, yay, mom's coming again. So that part of it was, I think it was just that I really knew, but what I will tell you now is despite everything that anorexia threw at me and said, our bond is unbreakable. I mean, she will sometimes give talks with me and she will say to people, if I relapse when I'm 50 and my mom is 80, she's got me. You know, she's got me. So I do think, you know, one of the things early on, I sort of thought about the fact when she was 9 weeks old, she had respiratory syncytiavirus and she was at Children's Hospital for 3 days while she had pneumonia and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things they do then is they do breathing treatments, which, you know, involve putting a tube down the nose and then into the lungs and, you know, sucking everything out. And when it was time for her first breathing treatment, the nurse and the respiratory tech came in and they said, Mom, you're going to want to wait in the hallway for this. And I was like, why would I wait in the hallway? And they said, it's too painful for you to see. And I said, and why would something that painful be something I'd allow my daughter to go through alone? I don't think that's happening. And so I was there for every breathing treatment. And I really sort of approached this the very same way. And I looked at the food as she is being faced with a plate of snakes and spiders every time she's, every time we have her eat. I too will eat the snakes and spiders. And so, you know, I said pretty early on, look, if I have to gain 50 pounds for every 5 you gain, well, then that's the way that's going to go. And that did not happen. But I think that was an important piece of solidarity. And so once it really was, you know, effective, I would say the first year was the most intense period. And then it, you know, slowed down after that. And by year, because I think we're so aggressive, by the end of year 3, she was actually able to go study abroad.
Wow.
So, but she also knew that if I needed to get on a plane to Australia and bring her home, that'd be happening too. Cause I have like 19 million mom friends in Australia. So there's no escaping my reach. But she really, the way she speaks about it now to people, I actually had, was very interesting. Someone found her Instagram from my posts or something like that and messaged her and said, how does it make you feel that your mother speaks so openly about your recovery? How do you feel pressured? And she said, oh gosh, no, I feel accountable. And she said, so no, I think it's great. And so she's very much, we're a lot alike. And that's one of the things I really loved about the UCSD program is they said, the day we got there, they said, welcome to UCSD. You're the expert in your child. We're the expert on eating disorders. Together, we're the treatment team. And so I think I have a lot of insight into how she thinks because I think we think a lot alike. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the ability to use that and all was important. But it's just a core value of ours, too, at this point that, you know, it's important to be open. She has to acknowledge her risk stuff and all that kind of thing. But she literally... she herself thinks of me as a warrior and her father as well. And you may have read, and maybe we could put it in the show notes, the letter she wrote to other parents saying, you know, open letter to parents, you know, my parents loved me enough to let me hate them. And it never was her hating us, but it sure did look a lot like it.
Right.
That horrible, it's the terrible, terrible, just the terrible truth of anorexia is that it's not your kid's brain anymore, but it's their face and it's their voice and it's all your memories of them. And it's just, it's so cruel to all of us.
It is. It is to everyone that's in their, you know, in their circle. It definitely is cruel. And I didn't put this on the questions, but I know that you've helped me understand this. And I thought that you could speak just slightly to just this idea of kind of the weight, you know, we talked about weight restoration and growth charts and, you know, we don't have to go into all the details, but you really helped me. I hadn't really heard the things that you had talked to me about looking at past weight charts to see where your child should be at weight-wise as they restore and then why that's important to get to that point so that the brain can heal and all that. I feel like I'd love for you to share a little bit of that with the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you know, we're very lucky UCSD Cutting Edge believes in involving parents. So when they were looking at the weight and the target weight, they actually, showed me. So they didn't just say, this is what it is. They were like, this is what it is. And this is how we came up with it. And I think that I took a special interest in it because we had an unusual thing. She had a sort of a very steady growth curve, height and growth, like tracking the same way. And she was always a little bit of a peanut among her friends. And so average height and then tiny. And then when she was in her freshman year of high school, she grew from 5'3 to 5'10 that year. So that is not everybody's growth chart. And so the team, you know, explaining it to me how that worked really got me interested in more about that. And then understanding, as I tell people, there's been very little research into the weight because up until about like 10 years ago, they were trying to figure out how you and I did this to our kids. And so nobody was looking at the weight in any lens other than let's just get them to a minimally healthy, physically healthy BMI. So, I'm not going to go into too many details, like you said, because it's a long explanation, but the Minnesota Starvation Experiment is, you know, I think a very telling experiment. Those were men who were starved and then refed as conscientious objectors in World War II. And they almost all went to 110% of what they had weighed before. And way back when this was being looked at, a large segment of the eating disorders treatment and just clinical, you know, people looked at that and said, well, gosh, we better not let that happen to our people that are recovering. We better stop that, you know, instead of seeing biologically that makes a lot of sense. If you've been through a period of famine, you're going to have to go higher. And so I am hashtag team 110%. And so I think it's really important to look at their growth chart, look at the totality of it. When I do it for people through my business, it takes me about 90 minutes to really put all the data. I look at it in various lenses and stuff like that to really get a good idea of where they have been. And, you know, one of the huge problems is oftentimes people will look at the weight in isolation. And I just looked at a growth chart not 2 weeks ago where the child had always been on the 50% weight curve. And so then the treatment team was just, you know, okay, put her back to the 50% weight curve. And I looked at it and I said, okay, yes, she's always been at the 50% weight curve, but do you notice she went up to, she was also at the 50% height curve and now she's at the 75% height curve, you know? So it's not just anything in isolation and, you know, that matters. And so many of us have seen it, just that, you know, sort of the magic that happens. And our personal experience was at 100%. Our daughter was she was so much better. And that's oftentimes for us parents too, the siren call is better, not well. But my husband and I really mourned the loss of our sort of carefree, you know, real spitfire, you know, daughter. And she was just a more rigid, more anxious, just really honestly less pleasant version of herself at 100% of her growth curve. And then when the wheels sort of fell off the bus and, you know, had to kind of go back to square one, when she put on that extra 10% of her weight, she was back, baby. I mean, she was back. And she herself even said, and for people who don't really aren't much into this, we had done sort of sighted blind weights with her, so she didn't know, then sighted weights, and then she decided, knowing my weight doesn't really make me happy, I'm not going to know. So I remember, because I came back from a trip, and she said, hey, do you want to know how much I weigh? And inside my head was like, if you picture Munch's a scream inside my head, but I have DBT training from UCSD, and I said, oh, weighing yourself, that's an interesting choice. That choice. And she said, I wanted to know the number that set me free. And that number was 10% over what she, air quotes, should weigh. And so that I have really become, you know, because you see what I write. I mean, this is my, you know, this is my rallying cry. You know, when a surgeon's taking out a cancerous tumor, they do not cut as close as they can to the margin and risk leaving some there. In the schizophrenia and bipolar communities, those meds often cause weight gain. And so they have a saying, sanity before vanity. So in my opinion, with, you know, most people, the easiest to adjust variable, and easy being a very relative term in this, in this field, is the weight. And so when I, you know, when someone is just barely sort of, you know, the mistake often is a generic number. So generic anything cannot work. But even personally, when they're just sort of at their 100% and then they're not well again and they are, you know, so let's add meds and let's do this. And I'm like, there may be a need for meds. We did meds. I'm not anti-meds at all. I'm not saying that. But why would we not just try some more weight first and see if that happens? And so I think a huge problem in the eating disorders world is that it is afraid of the same things that anorexia is afraid of. And if your clinicians are afraid of it, well, that's certainly not going to instill confidence in you as a parent to do something different. So, you know, I just think we really need to, in fact, I posted something on my personal coaching page today about this. That was a article from Laura Collins from Feast. And then one of the moms from the pages had, you know, said something, and she said, anorexia recovery needs to be a fat positive experience, because, you know, we can't say, and we don't know exactly what the right number is, but we certainly would rather, you know, make sure that we cleared that hurdle instead of staying just under it and keeping our kids unwell. And it's amazing. You'll do one of the exercises they sometimes do with people is sort of a like, okay, how did you feel at this weight? And then how did you feel at this weight? And how did you feel at this weight? And what you'll find when it's put down on paper is at your lowest weight, you feel the worst and you actually feel the heaviest. And I don't want to say this in a way that there's anything pejorative about higher weight, because I'm very weight neutral. You know, I'm not fatphobic or anything like that, or thin bias. But they will then find that then when they're at their highest weight is when they feel their best and start to see themselves clearly. And I'm really clear with people too. Sometimes people will say, well, there's still some body image stuff. And I'm like, well, did you think having anorexia was going to make them better than all the other girls and women in America? Because probably not. So, you know, it's pretty natural that some of that residual stuff remains, and we can work on that, and we should work on it. All of us should work on it, because again, you know, most of us in America do have some body image stuff, but it gets a lot better oftentimes, you know. And I know you've seen the pages with the parents, some of them who have resisted. My favorite story on that comes from a mom who posted a lovely picture of her daughter at her wedding and all this kind of stuff, and said, you know, I haven't posted for a while because I haven't needed to, because things have been going so well. But, you know, going in the Wayback Machine, you know, I kept posting about how my daughter was weight restored, but she still had A, B, C, and D issues going on. And there was this annoying group of moms who would say, try more weight. And she says, I keep, you know, basically was like, damn them, don't they know she already weighs enough? Why do they keep telling me this? And she said, and after 4 years of that, I thought, well, what do we have to lose? And she said, oh my God, at 30 pounds more than any doctor ever said she had to weigh, now she's living her life, you know? So I think that's really important for all of us. Do not be thin biased, do not be fat phobic, and do not go to clinicians who are.
Right. Absolutely. Very, very, very wise words, and ones that people need to hear, myself and my daughter included.
Yeah. And the hard thing is they can't hear it. You know, that is the hardest thing. Yeah.
Right. Right. But I think, like you said, is asking those questions of the clinicians that you're choosing, or that your child is choosing, you know, asking those questions, because again, as until I met you and talked with you, I wasn't asking those questions, and we weren't talking about those things.
No, and most people, they will not, in general, I mean, most places, most clinicians are really not going to put that on your radar. Traditionally, weight restoration has been a minimally physically healthy weight where your vitals are stable. And then we just assume that that's that. And there's a whole lot of daylight between physical health and full mental health. And so I actually like to use the terms moving target weight and brain restoration. Like that's my mission, to put those things into the lexicon, because I think that's really what we're talking about. And I do think from a clinical standpoint that parents and the person impacted are so, you know, we're so overwhelmed, we're so scared, we don't know what to do, that if you give us a number, then that seems like I can climb that mountain. Okay, I can get to whatever that number is. And if they're not given context early on, look, this is just a guess, this is just a beginning. You know, I've talked to people whose kids have, you know, sort of relapsed, and they say, but they're, you know, they're weight restored, how can this be? And it turns out that's the number they gave them at 13. Well, they're 16 now, you know, and I don't think parents are missing the boat. I think the clinical field does a really terrible job of explaining it. And I also think that we have so many wrongheaded ideas from society, because I mentioned that part of our story was not wanting to put on the freshman 15. Imagine my surprise to find out that the freshman 15 is actually 7 to 10 pounds, and that's how much an 18-year-old is supposed to gain.
So what would you say, as we're closing up today, what would you say, one thing, two things, just to perhaps a mom that's out there that's struggling, parents, you know?
Yeah. Well, I would say, you know, first of all, we are so lucky in the days of the internet, you know, to have the resources we have. You mentioned a lot of online forums. I am a board member of Feast, and so I think the Feast website is a great place to start, because it's fully run by families and takes no treatment center money. That's a whole nother podcast we could do if we want to talk about treatment center money. But so if you want information that is, you know, is that parents, really smart, involved, educated parents have vetted to make sure that it benefits kids and families and not any other agenda. I feel very confident with Feast being that group, so I'd visit that page. And then just really understanding you're going to have to do a lot of stuff that's very counterintuitive. And I'm known for saying you have to see the beast to slay the beast. And, you know, we've talked particularly specifically about anorexia, which is, you know, our experience. And so, you know, things can vary a little bit for other people, but truly, you know, once that's why multifamily and all the families talking to each other are so valuable, because had I not known that it was normal for my daughter to throw something at me, you know, I just would have said, well, clearly this can't be right to do this because it makes her throw things at me. Mm-hmm. And instead I had the training to say, yeah, that's going to happen. And here, let's give you some skills and, you know, how you can do it better. And I would say, I think the other thing that I would really say is understand that there's no sending your kid away and having them come back better. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. 1 to 3 years is the most optimistic timeline for recovery. 7 years is average. So from the very beginning, go in knowing that that's it. And it's not all as bad as the initial days. You know, I don't want anybody to just curl up and cry mm-hmm. and give up right now. But there are also very specific skills that you can be taught, you know, just like you were taught to do other parenting techniques. And so, you know, again, look for the people that can help you with that. And, you know, especially if you have a child under 18, and I would argue even under any child who's still being supported by you, their independence is not more important than their health. So you may need to change a clinician's mind, or change the clinician if you can't change the mind, about the level of your involvement. And it's really important for you to know what they're learning, because that's how you help them. So if your kid's going somewhere and getting therapy all day, but you're not informed about any of it, you don't know then how to help them access those skills and things like that. Right. So that's vital too.
Right. Absolutely. Really good. Really good stuff. Thank you so much, JD. Now, where can people find you if they want to connect with you? Again, I'll put things in show notes, but where can they find you?
Absolutely. So I do have my own website, which is jdoulette.com. So it's jdoulette.com. Mm-hmm. I have my Facebook page, JD Olette Peer Coaching. Those are great places to find me. And I'm on, you know, Instagram, Twitter, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And one of the things I do, and I'll do this for as long as I can, you know, since I started my coaching business after, it's a whole nother story again, that's another podcast, but the mm-hmm. school I worked for went out of business precipitously last year. And in my journey to discover myself at the age of 55, I've ended up doing this. I will, talk to any parent for 15 to 30 minutes just to kind of try and get them on the right track, or, you know, that sort of thing. So I have on my website, I have a form that you can fill out if you want to do a quick chat. And I hope I haven't talked too fast in your podcast, because I am mm-hmm. a fast talker, but I always tell people, man, I can cover a lot of ground in 30 mm-hmm. minutes. You know, right. I can do the primer that you need to get started in the right direction. Because parents want to do the right thing, but really sadly, too often, as you know, either the people advising them don't know the right thing, or they're not telling them that. And mm-hmm. that is the hardest part of this work, is to encounter families who have been fighting as hard as they can for multiple years. And, you know, you'll ask them basic questions and nobody's ever said anything about those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. Yeah. JD, so good. Like, you're an expert by experience, and I think that's what we need to do. And hopefully this podcast has really provided some great information for others from your experience, from a little bit of my experience too. But again, so thankful and grateful that you could join us today and share all this with you. And I'm glad that the listeners were here, and we'll talk with you later.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. Okay.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Do you feel like your juggling of your chaos is just too much and you want to reclaim your life and health? I'm here to help. I offer free 30-minute consultations where I can show you simple steps to help you get back on track. If you're interested, please connect with me. You can do that simply by reaching out on Instagram and send me a DM at @GreenGorski, or email me at Moira@GorskiWellness.com. Moira spelled M-O-Y-R-A. I look forward to hearing from you, and take care.